Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Smith, your guide to cutting through the noise and getting straight to the insights.
And I'm Taylor Johnson, here to help connect the dots and explore the broader implications of today's information.
Today, we're embarking on a truly comprehensive deep dive into the Federal Register for Wednesday, August 20th, 2025. This is a document that honestly touches nearly every aspect of American life, often without us even realizing it. It's the government's official daily publication.
It really is. And what's fascinating, I think, is how this single publication captures the pulse of federal activity across, well, every single sector.
Right.
It's the official public record where government agencies announce everything, new rules, proposed changes, public notices, even presidential documents. It's all in there.
Exactly. And our mission for this deep dive is pretty simple. We give you a shortcut to being well-informed.
Yeah, cut through the jargon.
We're going to pull out the most important nuggets, highlight maybe some surprising facts, and really explain what each one means for you, all from today's edition. So buckle up. Okay, let's unpack this.
The rules, what's changing today?
All right, we're going to start with the rules section of the Federal Register. These are finalized regulations. They have the full force of law.
Right, so these aren't just suggestions or proposals anymore. These are the things that are actually changing or have already changed. They've gone through the whole process, comments and all.
Got it. So first up, something impacting environmental health and also industry. It's a notice from the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, about trichloroethylene, or TCE.
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't actually a new rule, is it? It's more like a delay.
That's exactly right. The EPA is extending a postponement. They're pushing back certain parts of its final rule on TCE for another 90 days.
Okay.
So that moves the effective date to November 17th, 2025. And this specifically hits conditions related to uses that have TSCA exemptions. That's the Toxic Substances Control Act.
And this isn't the first delay you mentioned.
No, not at all. The original rule actually came out way back on December 17th, 2024.
Wow.
Yeah, but its effective date got pushed to March 21st, 2025, then again to June 20th, 2025. So this is the, what, third delay now? It's becoming a pattern?
So why all the delays? What's holding this up? A rule from almost a year ago.
Well, the EPA says, and this is the official language, that justice so requires this extension. And the reason is ongoing litigation.
Ah, lawsuits.
Exactly. Industrial petitioners specifically named are Alliance, Microporous, and PPG. They raised what the EPA called serious questions about the Workplace Chemical Protection Program aspects of the rule.
Okay.
So under the Administrative Procedure Act, Section 705, an agency can postpone a rule's effective date while it's under judicial review. They don't need new public comment for this kind of pause because it's just maintaining the status quo while the courts figure things out.
So like one specific example is the use of TCE as a processing aid for making specialty polymeric microporous sheet material. That use is affected by this delay.
Precisely. That's one of the conditions of use covered by this postponement.
So, boiling it down, what does this mean for you, the listener? It means that for certain industries using TCE, these stricter regulations that were supposed to be in effect, they're still on hold.
Right. It highlights that significant legal and policy tug of war that often happens between environmental protection goals and, you know, the operational realities and costs for industry.
A real regulatory limbo.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up, shifting gears completely, let's talk aviation safety. The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has issued a final rule. This one concerns certain Siam Hiller helicopters, the UH-12E and UH-12EL models.
Mm-hmm. And that also includes some Army models, the OH-23G and H-23F.
Right. What prompted this?
Well, it was triggered by reports of two cracks found in a main rotor drive shaft, the MR drive shaft, during an inspection. That's obviously a critical component.
Yeah, you don't want cracks there.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
So the FAA is stepping in to tackle two issues, non-conforming parts potentially being out there, and also the use of improper paint strippers on these shafts.
Improper paint strippers. How does that factor in?
Well, certain chemicals can actually damage or weaken the metal. So the new rule does a few things. It requires inspections of certain MR drive shafts for cracks. It prohibits installing specific drive shafts unless they've been inspected. And this is key. It bans using any paint stripper other than two specific types, TTR 248 or TTR 2918 Type I on any part of the MR drive shaft.
That sounds incredibly specific, but obviously critical for safety. What happens if this isn't addressed? What's the risk?
The FAA is very clear on this. They state, and I'm quoting here, if not addressed, this unsafe condition could result in separation of the MR drive shaft and MR bleeds from the helicopter and consequent loss of control of the helicopter.
Wow, okay, that's catastrophic. Separation of the main rotor.
Exactly. So the stakes are incredibly high. Now, they've set a compliance timeline. Operators have to do these inspections and ensure compliance within 4 years of the rule's effective date or at the next MR transmission assembly overhaul, whichever happens first.
Okay, so there's a window, but it's a firm deadline. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, I thought. The rule actually mentions comments they received, specifically from Summit Helicopters, about the cost.
Ah, yes, the economic impact. Yeah. That always comes up.
Right. They pointed out additional costs the FAA maybe hadn't fully considered, things like baking the part, shipping, the labor for removing and reinstalling it. Mm. They estimated that adds about 11.5 extra hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
And they also said the actual stripping, baking, inspecting, priming, painting process, that takes closer to 6.5 hours, not the 5 hours the FAA initially estimated.
Yeah, and it's important the FAA acknowledges that. It shows they're not just issuing safety mandates in a vacuum. They have to consider the practical and economic burden on the operators, even while prioritizing safety. It's always a balance.
So where does the FAA get the authority for this kind of rule?
It comes directly from the U.S. Code, specifically Section 4471 of Subtitle 7, Part A, Subpart 3. That section explicitly charges the FAA with promoting safe flight. So addressing an unsafe condition like this falls squarely within their legal mandate.
Okay, sticking with the FAA for a moment longer, they've also issued what they call miscellaneous amendments to some critical flight procedures. These are the SIAPs and ODPs.
That's right. Standard instrument approach procedures, the SIAPs and takeoff minimums, and obstacle departure procedures, the ODPs.
So what exactly are those in plain English?
They're essentially the incredibly detailed instructions and flight paths pilots use for landing and taking off, especially when visibility is poor or there are obstacles around the airport. Think altitudes, headings, specific points to fly over.
Got it.
And the Federal Register itself notes that because these are so complex and there are so many of them nationwide, it's just expensive and impractical to print them all in the register every time they're updated.
Okay, so if they're not fully published here, how do pilots and air traffic control and everyone actually get these crucial updates?
It's all digital now, essentially. All the current SIAPs and ODPs are available online totally free of charge at a specific FAA website, nfdc.faa.gov. Pilots access them through their electronic flight bags and charts.
Makes sense.
And this amendment we're seeing today, it updates the relevant federal regulation, 14 CFR Part 97. It becomes effective basically as soon as each specific procedure is published electronically. And importantly, for safety, it incorporates changes from what are called FDC permanent NOTAMS notices to airmen. These are treated as emergency actions of immediate flight safety.
So this really raises the question of speed, doesn't it? How quickly can this critical safety info get out to pilots when, lives could literally be on the line?
Absolutely. And the FAA explicitly addresses that. They state that the circumstances here required making these changes effective in less than the usual 30-day waiting period. They cite impracticability and the public interest in safety as reasons for not going through the formal notice and public comment procedure for these specific updates.
And they list examples, right? Like Miller, South Dakota.
Yes. Rutherfordton, North Carolina, Wichita, Kansas, all with an effective date of October 2nd, 2025. It's the government making these necessary, sometimes rapid, safety adjustments for air travel, prioritizing safety over standard procedure when needed.
All right. Now, for something that sounds, intriguing. From the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, an entry titled Delete, 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 Removal of Obsolete Regulations.
Huh. Yeah, that title definitely catches the eye. It sounds like they're doing some regulatory house cleaning.
Exactly. What's this about?
So the FCC is using a specific process called a direct final rule to get rid of these old, outdated regulations. It's a more streamlined way to do it.
A direct final rule. How does that work differently from normal rulemaking?
Well, normally an agency proposes a rule, takes public comment, then issues a final rule. With a direct final rule, the agency basically says, we're finalizing this change, effective on X date, unless we receive significant adverse comments by Y date.
Ah, okay. So it flips the script a bit?
Right. They can just make certain changes without prior notice under what's called the good cause standard. But here they've chosen this direct final rule approach specifically to provide, as they put it, expanded opportunities for public comment, even though it might not have been strictly required legally for these types of removals.
So how does the public actually interact with this then, if it's already final in a sense?
Good question. It means the changes are adopted without that prior notice and comment period. But, and this is the key part, the publication is accompanied by a 20-day window for the public to file comments.
Okay.
If anyone files comments that the FCC deems significant adverse comments, then the rule change gets stopped. It doesn't take effect, and the FCC would have to go back and do a full traditional notice and comment rulemaking process if they still wanted to proceed.
And if comments are filed, but they're not considered significant,
then the rule change just goes ahead as planned. And interestingly, if no comments are filed at all, the changes take effect on the specified date, and the FCC doesn't even publish a follow-up notice confirming it. It just happens.
Huh. Seems efficient, but relies on people spotting potential issues quickly.
It does. They do note some amendments here will be effective 60 days after publication regardless, so there's a bit of variation. But overall, yeah, it looks like the FCC trying to be more efficient, clean out the regulatory attic while still leaving a door open, albeit a conditional one, for public feedback.
Proposed rules, what might change soon?
Okay, moving on from rules that are now final, let's look at the proposed rules section. This gives us a glimpse into what might be coming down the pipeline, future regulations, policy shifts.
And crucially, this is often where you, the public, have your primary opportunity to weigh in, to submit comments, and actually influence the final shape of these regulations.
Right, your chance to be heard before it becomes law. So we have another FAA entry here, but this time it's actually a withdrawal.
Correct. The FAA is withdrawing a notice of proposed rulemaking, an NPRM, related to airspace in Morgantown, West Virginia.
What was that original proposal about?
It was published back on June 30th, 2025, and it proposed changes to the Class D and Class E airspace around Morgantown.
Okay, so why are they pulling it back?
The FAA states the reason is that new airspace data have been received, which significantly changed the requirements for the proposed airspace. Basically, new information came to light that makes the original proposal outdated or inappropriate.
So they'll likely try again later.
That's the plan. The FAA says they expect to publish a new NPRM after they've had a chance to fully assess this new data. It really shows how dynamic airspace management has to be, constantly adapting to new information, technology, flight patterns. It's never static.
Also from the FAA, another proposed rule. This one involves Oakwood, Texas. They're proposing to revoke Class E airspace there.
That's right. And the reason for this proposed revocation is straightforward. The instrument procedures at Carter Ranch Airport in Oakwood have been canceled.
Ah, so if there are no instrument approaches, maybe the controlled airspace isn't needed anymore.
That's typically the logic. Class E airspace often exists specifically to protect aircraft operating under instrument flight rules. If those procedures are gone, the justification for that controlled airspace might disappear too.
And they're asking for comments on this.
Yes, they are. And they're asking for pretty broad input comments on the overall regulatory, aeronautical, economic, environmental, and energy-related aspects of this proposed revocation.
Wow, that's a wide net.
It is. Comments are due by October 6, 2025. It raises that interesting question again. How do changes at a single, perhaps smaller, local airport ripple up to the federal level and trigger this kind of comprehensive review and public input process? It shows the interconnectedness, doesn't it?
Notices, announcements, and calls for action.
All right, let's dive into the notices section now. This is often the most diverse part of the Federal Register. You find everything here, meeting announcements, requests for data, significant administrative decisions.
Exactly. These notices are really the bread and butter of daily government operation and transparency. They might announce the groundwork for future rules or just detail routine administrative actions. It's where you see the gears of government turning.
Okay, first up, a notice from the Coast Guard about their agency information collection activities. This sounds less like a rule and more about how the government gathers data.
That's precisely it. The Coast Guard, like many agencies, has to get approval for the information it requires the public or industry to submit. This notice invites comments on those requirements.
What are they asking for feedback on?
They specifically want comments on the practical utility of the information they collect. Is it actually useful? Also, the accuracy of the estimated burden. Do they have a realistic idea of how long it takes people to fill out these forms?
Right.
And crucially, ways to enhance the quality, utility, and clarity of information, and ways to minimize the burden, including the use of automated collection techniques or other forms of information technology. Basically, how can we get the info we need without making it overly painful for you?
Makes sense. Is there an example of the kind of information they're talking about here?
Yes, they highlight one specific collection related to barges carrying bulk hazardous materials. That's OMB control number 16250104. The information collected there is needed, they say, to ensure the safe shipment of bulk hazardous liquids in barges, make sure the barges meet safety standards, and ensure the crews have the necessary safety info. So it directly ties into maritime safety.
Got it. So it's the agency trying to fine-tune its data gathering for critical functions while being mindful of the burden it places on those providing the data. Okay, moving into a different world now, creative rights and royalties. The Copyright Royalty Board, what's happening there?
The copyright royalty judges are officially starting proceedings to figure out how to distribute the royalty funds collected from satellite and cable carriers back in 2022.
So this is about getting musicians, writers, studios, etc., paid when their work is retransmitted.
Exactly. When cable or satellite companies retransmit broadcast signals, they pay royalty fees into these funds. Now the judges have to decide how to divide that money among the copyright holders whose work was actually used.
And it sounds like it's not always straightforward.
No, the notice explicitly mentions there are existing controversies regarding the distribution. That's why these formal legal proceedings are necessary. Different groups often claim they deserve a bigger slice of the pie.
So if you're a copyright holder who thinks they're owed money from these 2022 funds, what do you need to do?
You need to act relatively quickly. Any party who wants to participate and potentially receive a share of these royalties must file a petition to participate and pay a $150 filing fee.
Deadlines.
Yes. For the satellite funds, the deadline is September 19th, 2025. For the cable funds, it's September 22nd, 2025. And they note that corporate parties have to be represented by an attorney.
Okay, so this really peels back the curtain on the complex financial plumbing behind how creators get paid in the modern media landscape. All right, shifting to military justice now. A notice from the Department of Defense.
Yes, this concerns the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. They're announcing proposed changes to their own rules of practice and procedure, specifically Rules 22 and 26.
What do those rules cover?
Rule 22 deals with something called the Certificate for Review. The notice mentions a proposed redrafting of this rule, and it includes a specific format that the judge, advocate general, and government appellate lawyers would need to use.
So, procedural updates for military appeals.
Essentially, yes. It's about the detailed mechanics of how cases move through that specific military appeals court. And importantly, they are inviting public comments on these proposed changes. It connects to those fundamental principles of fairness and due process, even within the military legal system.
Now, for a couple of notices from the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, these look like enforcement actions. First, regarding a Dr. Kenneth Fearson.
Yes, this is a final decision and order from the DEA, and it's pretty direct. The DEA has ordered the revocation of Dr. Fearson's DEA registration.
Why? What's the reason?
It's straightforward. The DEA found he lacks the authority to practice as an osteopathic physician in Florida because his state medical license was suspended.
Ah.
DEA regulations and federal law are very clear on this. To have a federal DEA registration to dispense controlled substances, you must be authorized to practice and dispense under the laws of the state where you practice. If your state license is gone, your federal registration is invalid.
So state authority is the foundation for the federal authority in this case.
Absolutely. No state license, no DEA registration, period.
Okay, the next DEA notice seems much more detailed. This is a decision and order regarding Dr. Andrew Conan.
Yes, this one is significantly more complex and sheds light on both prescribing practices and, interestingly, legal representation issues. The outcome is the same. Revocation of Dr. Conan's DEA certificate of registration, effective September 19th, 2025.
So his registration is revoked, and any pending applications are denied. What led to this?
The core finding is that Dr. Conan prescribed Schedule II through officially controlled substances outside the course of professional practice and not for a legitimate medical purpose. This occurred over a period from January 2015 to July 2020.
Okay, that's a serious allegation. How did the DEA reach that conclusion?
This is where it gets procedurally interesting. The conclusion was based on deemed admitted facts.
Deemed admitted, what does that mean?
It means that Dr. Conan, through his lawyer, essentially failed to respond properly or contest the allegations during the administrative hearing process. They failed to otherwise defend or comply with the administrative law judge's orders. So, under the rules, the allegations made by the DEA were taken as true, basically a default judgment.
Wow. So, what were the specific violations alleged that were then deemed admitted.
The DEA found multiple violations of Texas state law, including the Texas Health and Safety Code and the Texas Administrative Code. Texas law, like most states, requires a valid medical purpose and sound clinical judgment when prescribing controlled substances. It emphasizes that physicians should help and not to harm patients and the public.
Okay.
The deemed admitted facts showed that Dr. Conan failed to establish adequately supported diagnoses for three specific patients before prescribing controlled substances to them.
And the lawyer's actions were a big part of this outcome.
A huge part. The decision document spends a lot of time detailing the actions or inactions of Dr. Conan's attorney. The attorney repeatedly missed deadlines for filing a crucial document called a pre-hearing statement, despite warnings from the judge about possible sanctions, including waiver of the hearing and default.
What reasons did the attorney give?
The attorney cited administrative chaos and scheduling difficulties, and also personal illness. However, the agency noted in its decision that the attorney also admitted to completing other significant legal work during that same period, like contacting federal prosecutors about a related matter and preparing a separate lawsuit.
So the implication is the attorney prioritized other work, even with potential health issues, and that led to missing the deadlines in the DEA case.
That seems to be precisely the agency's conclusion. They essentially found the excuses insufficient given the evidence of other work being done.
And Dr. Conan is held responsible for his attorney's failure.
Yes. The agency explicitly relied on a Supreme Court precedent, Link v. Wabash Railroad Company from 1962. That case basically holds that a client is generally bound by the acts or omissions of their chosen lawyer agent. So Dr. Conan ultimately suffered the consequences, the revocation, because his attorney failed to comply with the procedural requirements.
That's a harsh lesson. This whole case is a really deep dive into DEA enforcement, the standards for prescribing controlled substances, and just how critical effective legal representation is in these administrative proceedings.
Absolutely. It underscores the high bar for medical conduct and the significant consequences of procedural failures.
Okay, back to information collection notices. The Department of Energy is also seeking comments on its activities.
Right. And this notice gives us a sense of the sheer scale of this data flow. For the Department of Energy alone, they estimate the total annual burden on respondents is almost 30,000 hours.
29,794 hours, to be exact.
Yeah, and the estimated annual cost burden just for reporting and record keeping is over $2.2 million. That's based on over 14,000 responses annually.
That's a significant cost. It really raises the question, who ultimately bears these costs of regulatory compliance? Is it the companies? Or does it get passed on to consumers and energy prices? And how does it affect energy projects overall?
It's a crucial question. These are often hidden costs embedded within the system.
All right, let's look at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. They regulate interstate transmission of electricity, natural gas, oil. Key player. Several notices from them today.
Yes, a busy day for FERC. First, we have Transcontinental Gas Pipeline Company, LLC. They're asking for more time and extension until December 31st, 2026 to finish their Central Louisiana Abandonment Project.
An offshore project.
Yes. It was originally supposed to be done by September 3rd, 2025. This just highlights a very common reality. Large-scale energy infrastructure projects often face delays and need regulatory flexibility to get completed.
Okay, what's next from FERC? Looks like a complex application involving Palo Duro.
Right. Palo Duro Transmission LP and Palo Duro Pipelines, Texas Gathering LP, they're seeking approval for a lease agreement. Essentially, Palo Duro Transmission wants to lease capacity on PD Gathering's header pipeline.
Where's this pipeline?
It extends from the Texas Panhandle into western Oklahoma. Palo Duro Transmission also wants a certificate to operate its existing 275-mile pipeline that connects into that header pipeline.
And they want more.
Yes. They're also seeking a blanket certificate for open access transportation services and approval for their proposed FERC gas tariff, which sets out their rates and terms of service. The deadline for anyone wanting to intervene in this case is September 5th, 2025.
So this is a prime example of how FERC oversees the development and operation of the massive natural gas pipeline networks that are critical for supplying energy across regions.
Exactly. It impacts gas supply, market competition, and ultimately, potentially, the prices consumers pay.
Okay, FERC also issued a combined notice of filings.
Right.
What's in that?
It bundles a few different items. One is Cherry Solar, LLC, submitting a notice of self-certification. They're declaring themselves an exempt wholesale generator, or EWG.
Which means?
It's a status under federal law that allows certain power generators, often renewable projects like solar farms, to operate with less extensive FERC regulation, primarily focused on selling power at wholesale. So it signals activity in renewable energy development.
Got it. What else in the combined notice?
There's also PJM Interconnection, LLC. PJM is a huge regional transmission organization managing the electric grid across 13 states and D.C.
Right.
They have filed a rate revision to a specific agreement, the Critical Transmission Owner Agreement for VEPCO, Virginia Electric and Power Company. This revision is set to be effective October 15th, 2025.
So changes in how the grid is managed and paid for in that region affects utility rates eventually?
Most likely, yes. It shows the ongoing adjustments needed to maintain reliability and manage costs in the electricity market.
And one more from FERC, an amendment application from Golden Pass LNG Terminal, LLC.
Yes. Golden Pass is a major liquefied natural gas export facility. This amendment to their authorization is currently undergoing environmental review by FERC staff.
And there's a timeline.
FERC says they aim to complete the environmental assessment or issue a notice of schedule for it within 90 days. Publishing that assessment or schedule will then inform other federal and state agencies about the timeline for completing their own necessary reviews for the project amendment.
So this highlights this significant environmental scrutiny these large energy export projects undergo.
Absolutely. Multiple agencies, multiple layers of review, especially concerning environmental impacts.
Okay, let's shift to something that directly impacts many communities and homeowners: flood hazards. We have notices from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Right. These are critical for anyone living in or owning property in flood-prone areas. First, FEMA is listing finalized changes in flood hazard determinations.
What kind of changes?
These are things like additions or modifications to base flood elevations, the BFEs, or changes to the boundaries of special flood hazard areas, the SFHAs, or changes to regulatory floodways. These are all shown on the official flood insurance rate maps, the FIRMS.
And these changes are happening now.
These specific ones are being finalized through what are called letters of map revision, or LOMRs. The notice lists affected communities in Alabama, California, North Carolina, Ohio, Oregon, and Texas, with various modification dates, mostly in June and July 2025.
And these changes have real-world consequences, right?
Definitely. They directly impact flood insurance requirements, whether you need it and how much it costs. They affect property values, local building codes, development decisions. Potentially thousands of properties are affected by these updates.
And besides finalized changes, FEMA also has proposed flood hazard determinations.
Exactly. This is the stage where the public gets a chance to review and comment on potential future changes to the flood maps.
So similar types of changes being proposed. New BFEs, new SFHA boundaries.
Yes. FEMA makes the preliminary maps and the supporting technical data, the flood insurance study reports, available online for public inspection.
And people can object or provide input.
Absolutely. Comments on these proposed determinations are due by November 18th, 2025. This is really important. It raises the question, how can you, as a citizen or homeowner, actually engage with these critical determinations? How can you check if your property is affected and provide feedback, especially as flood risks are changing with climate change and development?
A crucial opportunity for public engagement on something that hits very close to home for many. All right, more information collection, this time from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA. This seems to impact the housing appraisal industry.
Yes, the FHFA oversees Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Home Loan Banks. Their notice estimates the burden for their information collection activities. It's smaller scale than DOE, about 314 total hours annually.
Okay, what kind of info are they collecting?
It relates partly to their regulations for appraisal management companies, or AMCs. Those are the companies that connect lenders with appraisers.
Right.
The regulations require AMCs to provide written notices if they remove an appraiser from their network. They also require AMCs to disclose information about their owner specifically, anyone with a significant stake, over 10% who might have had an appraiser license refused or revoked in the past.
So this is about ensuring integrity and transparency in the appraisal process.
Exactly. It's part of the regulatory framework designed to protect consumers and ensure fairness and accuracy in real estate transactions. It's a peek into the unseen regulatory work that underpins the stability and integrity of the housing market.
Now, here's one that seems really important for public health. From HHS Health and Human Services, specifically the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's about hepatitis C virus, HCV.
Yes, this is a critical public health initiative. The notice announces a two-day convening, a meeting, aimed at establishing a roadmap for accelerating the diagnosis and treatment of HCV infection in the United States.
How big of a problem is hepatitis C right now?
It's a major challenge. The CDC estimates more than 2.4 million adults in the U.S. have HCV, and new infections are actually increasing, primarily linked to the ongoing injection drug use crisis.
And it's serious if untreated.
Very. Over half of new infections progress to chronic conditions. If left untreated, that can lead to advanced liver disease, liver cancer, and ultimately death.
But there's good news on the treatment front, right?
Huge news. Since 2013, we've had incredibly effective, safe treatments, direct-acting antivirals that can cure over 95% of people who receive them. The drugs are amazing.
So if treatment is so effective, what's the hurdle they're trying to overcome with this roadmap? Why isn't everyone getting cured?
Diagnosis and linkage to care remain the big challenges. A key limitation is the traditional testing approach, which usually starts with an antibody test. The problem is it can take 7 to 8 weeks after someone is infected for those antibodies to show up.
So you miss the early window.
Exactly. You miss the crucial early acute phase. And diagnosis can be delayed even longer in people who are immunocompromised. This convening will focus on leveraging newer, faster strategies like same-day diagnosis and treatment and viral-first testing.
Viral-first. What does that involve?
Instead of looking for antibodies first, you look directly for the virus itself. Real-time PCR tests can detect the virus's genetic material within just 1 to 2 weeks of infection. And there's another test, HCV core antigen testing, already approved outside the U.S., that can detect a viral protein in 2 to 3 weeks.
Much faster.
Much faster. And there's a push, noted from an earlier public health lab meeting in 2021, for the FDA to reclassify HCV diagnostic tests from the highest risk category, class 3, down to class 2, which could make development easier. And also a call for an FDA-cleared rapid point-of-care viral detection test, something you could potentially do right in a clinic or outreach setting and get results quickly.
So this notice really highlights how regulatory decisions about test classifications and the availability of different testing methods directly impact our ability to tackle a major public health crisis like Hep C. Faster, more accessible testing means getting people treated and cured sooner.
Precisely. It's about making the cure accessible.
Also from HHS, but this time from HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, looks like good news for early childhood development.
Yes, this is a notice of supplemental award. HRSA is giving additional funding to a group called 0-3 National Center for Infant, Toddler, and Families, Inc.
How much funding and what's for?
It's an extra $440,000 for fiscal year 2025. This money is intended to support the continuation of their existing work on the Early Childhood Developmental Health Systems Program.
What does that program do?
It aligns with direction from Congress and the budget appropriations, which aim to, and I quote, expand placements of early childhood development experts in pediatrician offices with a high percentage of Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program patients.
So putting experts right where young kids from lower income families are getting their checkups.
Exactly. This extra funding will help provide technical assistance to 4 additional program recipients, bringing the total to 8, and also support broader national dissemination of what they learn.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, it's really about early intervention, right? Catching developmental issues early and setting kids up for healthier futures, especially those who might face more barriers.
Absolutely. It's an investment right at the beginning of life, aimed at improving long-term outcomes for vulnerable children.
Okay, a brief notice here from the Justice Department related to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act.
Yes, this is just a standard notice about their ongoing information collection activities related to that act, known as REGE.
And REGE is the program that compensates people who got sick from.
From exposure to radiation, from atomic weapons testing, primarily in the West, or from uranium mining during the Cold War era. It provides compensation for certain cancers and other diseases linked to that exposure. This notice just indicates the routine administrative work needed to keep that compensation program running.
All right, let's unpack this next one. From NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. This looks complex. It's about an incidental harassment authorization, an IHA, for oil and gas exploration activities by a company called Narwhal LLC.
Yes, this is happening in West Harrison Bay, Alaska. And these IHAs are issued under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. They allow certain activities that might unintentionally disturb or take marine mammals, but only if the impact is negligible and certain mitigation measures are followed.
Okay, so what activities are narwhal doing and what kind of take is anticipated?
The activities covered are shallow water hazard surveys, likely using acoustic sources like seismic air guns or sparkers, and also offshore ice road and trail construction. The notice details potential take by level B harassment.
Level B harassment meaning?
Behavioral disturbance, things like marine mammals changing their swimming patterns, feeding behavior, or maybe experiencing a temporary shift in their hearing threshold due to the noise. It does not mean injury or death.
Which species might be affected?
The notice mentions bowhead whales, ringed seals, bearded seals, and spotted seals. It even estimates the potential number of takes based on the size of the area affected by the noise, the insonified area. For seismic air guns, they estimate between 20 and 710 level B takes, depending on the species, and for the sparkers, between 15 and 244.
But crucially, no serious injury or death is expected.
Correct. The notice states that take by level A harassment, which would involve injury or mortality, is not expected or authorized, specifically because of the rigorous mitigation measures narwhal has to implement.
Okay, so what are some of those mitigation measures designed to protect the animals?
They're quite expensive. A key one is establishing shutdown zones around the acoustic sources. If a marine mammal enters that zone, the activity has to stop immediately. The size of the zone varies by species and source, for example, 1,100 meters for low-frequency whales near the air gun, 350 meters for seals.
Wow, over a kilometer shutdown zone for whales.
Yes. There also has to be continuous visual monitoring by trained protected species observers, PSOs, during all daylight operations. At least two PSOs are required when the air gun is operating.
No.
Before starting the sound sources each day, they have to have a 15-minute clearance period where observers ensure the shutdown zone is clear. For the sparker, they also have to use a ramp-up procedure, starting the sound source gradually to give animals a chance to move away.
And what about the vessel operations and ice roads?
Strict vessel strike avoidance measures are required for all boats involved. For the ice trails, they have rules like avoiding known seal breathing holes or lairs by at least 150 meters, prohibiting any interaction with seals, and conducting regular surveys along the trails by dedicated observers to monitor for seals.
This sounds incredibly detailed and specific. Were there concerns raised during the public comment period on this?
Oh, absolutely. These kinds of authorizations in sensitive Arctic environments always draw scrutiny. The Arctic Peer Review Panel, for instance, recommended that the shallow water surveys should be finished by August 25th to avoid overlapping with the main bowhead whale migration and related subsistence hunts.
And did NOAA agree?
No, NMFS, the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is part of NOAA, and issues these IHAs, disagreed. They noted that the predicted level B harassment zone is actually outside the core whale migration corridor in that area. And importantly, narwhal has a conflict avoidance agreement in place with the affected Alaska Native communities like Koktovik, Nooksut, and Barrow to coordinate activities.
Any other groups weigh in?
Yes. The Center for Biological Diversity, CBD, argued that NMFS underestimated the impacts. They claimed, for example, that seals might haul out of the water due to noise from vessels or aircraft, not just the seismic sources, and that bowhead whales might change their vocalizations at noise levels below the official harassment threshold.
How did NMFS respond to that?
NMFS countered that avoidance behavior is the main expected response. The surveys are relatively brief, and specific mitigation measures are in place for aircraft and vessels as well. They did, however, acknowledge CBD's point about the cumulative stress on ice seals from climate change, confirming that this broader context was considered in their environmental analysis.
So after considering all this, what was the final determination by NMFS?
Ultimately, NMFS concluded that the total marine mammal take authorized will have a negligible impact on the affected species or stocks. This is based on factors like the relatively small footprint of the activity compared to the animal's overall habitat ranges and the determination that no impacts on reproduction or survival are expected.
And what about the impact on subsistence hunting?
They also found no unmitigable adverse impact on subsistence uses. They noted the project mostly avoids peak ice seal harvest times, and bowhead whale hunting is limited in this specific area compared to others.
Okay, so this is a really fascinating case study in how regulators try to balance energy development with wildlife protection. using detailed science, extensive mitigation requirements, and addressing public and community concerns.
Exactly. It's a complex process involving multiple stakeholders and a deep dive into potential environmental effects and how to minimize them.
All right, let's move from Arctic mammals to fish stocks.
Huh.
More from NOAA, this time regarding the New England Fishery Management Council. Looks like meeting notices.
Yes, notices for upcoming meetings of the Council's Groundfish Advisory Panel, its Recreational Advisory Panel, and its main Groundfish Committee.
Groundfish, so we're talking cod, haddock, flounder.
Precisely. Species like Atlantic cod are a major focus. The panels are scheduled to discuss revised drafts related to Amendment 25 Atlantic cod specifications and management. They'll also get updates on another package of rules called Framework Adjustment 72 Specifications and Management Measures.
So ongoing adjustments to fishing rules.
Constantly. They'll also look at something called a Joint New England and Mid-Atlantic Council Omnibus Alternative Gear Marking Framework.
Gear marking. Maybe trying to reduce lost gear or track fishing effort better.
Could be related to reducing whale entanglements, identifying whose gear is whose, or improving data. The Groundfish Committee will then take the recommendations from these advisory panels and synthesize them into advice for the full Fishery Management Council.
It really highlights that constant, iterative process of managing shared natural resources, doesn't it? Trying to balance the science on fish populations with the economic needs of the fishing communities.
Absolutely. It's a continuous cycle of data collection, analysis, stakeholder input, and regulatory adjustment.
Okay. Even the Postal Service makes an appearance in the Federal Register today. Notices related to negotiated service agreements, or NSAs.
Yeah. The Postal Service is required to give public notice when it files requests with its regulator, the Postal Regulatory Commission, PRC, to add these special contracts to its list of competitive products.
So these are like custom deals with big shippers?
Essentially, yes. They're contracts negotiated individually with large volume customers, offering potentially different rates or service features than standard published rates. The notices mention amendments to an existing contract. Priority Mail Express, Priority Mail, and USPS Ground Advantage Contract 530, and adding a completely new one, Priority Mail and USPS Ground Advantage Contract 810.
And the public can comment on these?
Yes. Comments are due to the PRC by August 25th, 2025. It raises an interesting question, doesn't it? How do these private agreements between the Postal Service and major corporations influence the broader postal landscape, the rates available to everyone else, and the overall competitiveness of the shipping industry for smaller businesses and individual mailers? That's the perennial question with NSAs, transparency versus competitive necessity.
All right, let's shift to the high-speed world of financial markets. The SEC Securities and Exchange Commission has a notice from Cboe EDGX Exchange, Inc. They're proposing a new market data report. This sounds potentially significant.
It does sound interesting. They're proposing to introduce something called an all-cancels report.
All cancels. What's notable about that?
What's fascinating is the level of detail. This report would provide subscribers with incredibly granular data on every single cancel-related message they send to the exchange's matching engine.
Regardless of whether the cancel actually worked.
Exactly. Regardless of whether the cancel attempt was successful, or even if it was associated with a trade execution. It apparently supplements existing reports that might only show missed cancels. This new report includes details like matching engine timestamps for when the cancel message was received and processed, and flags indicating if a message was delayed.
Okay, why is that level of detail so important for trading firms? Why track every single cancel attempt?
It's all about analyzing and optimizing their trading performance, especially their order management behavior, down to the microsecond level. By seeing all cancel attempts, successful or not, firms can identify patterns. Maybe their cancel messages are arriving too late in certain market conditions. Maybe there are latency issues in their systems.
So it helps them fine-tune their strategies.
Precisely. It helps them refine strategies to improve their cancel efficiency, react faster to changing market conditions, and ultimately better manage their risk and exposure in fast-moving markets. The exchange argues this increases transparency and democratizes information, although it's an optional paid data product available to all their trading permit holders.
So it's a deep dive into the cutting edge of market data, giving professional traders potentially another edge. And Cboe thinks this makes them more competitive.
Yeah, they state it enhances competition by expanding their product offerings, suggesting it might lead other exchanges to offer similar detailed reports.
Okay, another SEC notice, this one from the National Securities Clearing Corporation. Or NSCC. They play a huge role in clearing and settling trades. They want to remove a charge.
Yes, the NSCC is proposing to get rid of something called the other transactions charge.
Why are they removing it?
Their reasoning is twofold. First, they say the charge has become misaligned with the risk of the activity subject to the charge. Basically, the fee doesn't accurately reflect the risk NSCC takes on for those transactions anymore.
Okay.
Second, the actual amounts raised by this specific charge are now immaterial compared to the overall size of their clearing fund, which is the backstop against defaults. They also state that any risks related to the guaranteed activity covered by this charge are already adequately addressed by other charges they levy, like the mark-to-market charge. And some of the transaction codes related to it are being eliminated anyway.
So, connecting this to the bigger picture, it sounds like regulatory simplification. Getting rid of a fee that's become redundant or inefficient.
That seems to be the goal. Streamlining the complex fee structure for market participants when a particular charge no longer serves its original purpose or materially contributes to risk management.
And one more from the SEC related to market data offerings, this time concerning BOX Exchange LLC, an options exchange.
Yes, BOX Exchange is proposing to amend its rules to remove something called the liquidity taker event reports and also the fees associated with those reports.
So another data product being discontinued. Do we know why?
The notice itself doesn't detail the specific reasons why BOX wants to remove these reports. It just states their intention to do so. But it clearly impacts the suite of data available to market participants who trade on BOX and potentially their costs if they were subscribing to it.
So it raises that question again. What drives exchanges to remove data products they previously offered? Is it simply a lack of demand from traders? Or is it part of a broader strategic shift in what information they think is valuable or profitable to sell? We don't always get the full story from these notices.
No, often we just see the proposed change itself.
All right, let's look at a notice with a very direct impact for some small businesses from the Small Business Administration, the SBA, a disaster declaration amendment for New Mexico.
Yes, this is an amendment to an existing disaster declaration, specifically disaster declaration, hashtag 212102 and hashtag 212103. The SBA is adding Luna County, New Mexico to this declaration.
And what does that mean for businesses there?
It means they are now eligible to apply for economic injury loans only, or EIDL loans. So small businesses, small agricultural cooperatives, and most private nonprofits in Luna County that suffered economic injury, meaning lost revenue, etc., due to the disaster that triggered the original declaration, can now seek financial assistance from the SBA through these low-interest loans.
So a direct example of how federal agencies step in to help local communities and economies recover after disaster strikes.
Exactly. Expanding the reach of that support.
Okay, the Social Security Administration, SSA, manages a staggering amount of personal data. We have several notices from them today about their systems of records, or SORNs.
Right. These SORN notices are legally required under the Privacy Act, and they give us insights into how the SSA collects, maintains, uses, and protects our personal information. It's all about transparency.
So what systems are they updating or creating notices for today?
There are a few. One is a new system called Appointments and Interviews. This seems designed to manage their interactions with the public, more effectively scheduling appointments, tracking interviews. It collects data like your name, social security number, maybe travel info if relevant, immigration documents. The goal is better efficiency and resource allocation.
Okay, what else?
There's an update to the electronic enumeration records system. That's the system that handles how social security numbers are assigned. The notice clarifies how this data is used for program evaluation, research, and statistics, and states that personal identifiers are purged when possible for research uses.
Accountability seems to be a theme, too.
Yes. There's a notice for the Administrative Law Judge Public Alleged Misconduct Complaints system. This system processes complaints made against ALJs who hear Social Security disability cases, providing a formal channel for public accountability within that part of the administrative legal system.
And finally, something about digital identity.
Right. A new system notice for digital identity management. This is being set up to authenticate users accessing SSA's online services like the My Social Security portal, and crucially, to help prevent identity theft and fraud. It also allows them to use contact information provided for program outreach.
So across all these systems, managing appointments, assigning numbers, handling complaints, verifying identity online, what does this mean for you and the security of your data?
For all these systems, the SSA outlines its policies and practices for safeguarding the records. They talk about secure storage areas, strict access controls, only authorized personnel, audit mechanisms to track who accessed what, and mandatory annual security awareness training for all their personnel.
So they're detailing the protections.
Yes. But it always raises that fundamental question. How does a massive agency like the SSA, handling sensitive data for virtually every American, effectively balance the need for efficiency and modern service delivery with the absolute paramount need for robust data privacy and security in an age of increasing cyber threats? It's a constant challenge.
Okay. From the State Department now. A notice regarding the J-1 visa waiver recommendation application. This affects international exchange visitors, right?
Correct. The J-1 visa is for exchange visitors, students, researchers, scholars, au pairs. Many J-1 visa holders are subject to a 2-year foreign residence requirement, meaning they have to return to their home country for 2 years after their program ends before they can apply for certain other U.S. visas or permanent residency.
And this notice is about?
It's a request for public comments on a proposed revision to the application form used to request a waiver of that 2-year requirement. That form is the DS-3035. Waivers can be granted under specific circumstances, like if a U.S. government agency requests it or if the visitor would face persecution back home.
So they're potentially changing the application form.
Possibly tweaking it. The State Department estimates about 14,150 people apply for this waiver each year, and they estimate it takes about 1 hour to complete the form, totaling 14,150 annual burden hours. Comments on the proposed revision are due by September 19th, 2025. It highlights the administrative side of managing international talent flows and exchange programs.
Here's one from the Department of Transportation, DOT, Office of the Secretary. They're extending a comment period for a request for information, an RFI. What's the RFI about?
This is a big one. The RFI is seeking input for the next Surface Transportation Reauthorization Bill.
So the future of funding for roads, bridges, public transit, safety programs. Everything.
Exactly. These reauthorization bills are massive pieces of legislation that set funding levels and policy direction for usually 5 or 6 years. DOT put out the RFI back on July 21st, 2025, initially with just a 30-day comment period.
And they're extending it.
Yes. Yeah. Due to several requests for more time, they're extending the comment period until September 8th, 2025.
Why is this extension important?
It's crucial because these bills involve hundreds of billions of dollars and affect literally everyone who uses the transportation system. Giving stakeholders, states, cities, transit agencies, industry groups, safety advocates, the public more time to prepare thoughtful comments allows for better input into shaping that future legislation. It's the democratic process at work on huge infrastructure policy.
All right, here's a very specific but critical piece of the international trade puzzle. A notice from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP.
Yeah.
About commercial gaugers and laboratories.
Yes. CBP relies on accredited private companies to measure and test certain imported goods, especially bulk commodities like petroleum. This notice announces that one specific company, Quality Custom Inspections and Laboratories, Inc. in Pasadena, Texas, has been approved to gauge, meaning measure the quantity of petroleum and certain petroleum products.
And accredited to test them, too.
Yes, accredited to test them for customs purposes. This approval and accreditation is valid for 3 years, starting back on August 16, 2023. They list the specific American Petroleum Institute API gauging procedures. They're approved for things like tank gauging, temperature determination, sampling, calculating quantities.
And specific tests.
Yes, accredited for specific ASTM test methods, like determining sulfur content, flash point, density, viscosity, all critical quality parameters for petroleum products.
So this is a deep dive into those unseen but absolutely essential quality control mechanisms that underpin fair trade, right?
Yeah.
Ensuring importers pay the correct duties based on accurate quantity and quality, and protecting consumers and downstream industries.
Precisely. It's vital for the massive global trade in petroleum products.
Okay, let's turn to agriculture now. From the USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service, AMS, they're announcing designation opportunities under the U.S. Grain Standards Act. What does that mean?
It means that the current official designations for 7 private or state agencies that provide grain inspection and weighing services are coming to an end.
So these are the groups that officially grade grain, like corn or soybeans, for export or domestic trade.
Exactly. They ensure the grain meets official U.S. grade standards. Agencies like Champaign-Danville Grain Inspection, Omaha Grain Inspection Service, their current multi-year designations are expiring.
So AMS is looking for replacements or renewals?
Both. AMS is now requesting applications from entities, either private companies or state government agencies, who want to be designated to provide these official inspection and weighing services in those geographic areas.
And they want public input too.
Yes, crucially, AMS is also seeking comments from the public grain producers, elevators, exporters, anyone who uses these services, specifically on the quality of services provided by the seven agencies whose designations are ending.
Interesting. So performance review built in.
Seems like it. Applications to become a designated agency and comments on the existing agencies are due between September 1st and September 30th, 2025. The new designations can be for up to 5 years and cover specific geographic territories like parts of Michigan or broader areas across Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin.
It really raises that important question. How does the government ensure consistency, accuracy, and accountability in grading agricultural commodities, which are so vital to our economy and global trade? This designation process is key.
It is. It's about maintaining the integrity of the U.S. grain grading system.
Also from the USDA. This time, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS, a notice concerning animal health and international trade, specifically Newcastle disease in Switzerland.
Yes. APHIS is advising the public that it intends to reinstate the animal health status of two specific cantons or regions in Switzerland, Zurich, and Jura as being officially free of Newcastle disease.
Newcastle disease is a contagious bird disease, right?
Highly contagious, yes. Affects poultry, primarily. APAs had previously restricted imports from these areas due to outbreaks. Now, based on a risk assessment prepared by APHIS, they believe the disease is eradicated there again.
And the public can see this assessment.
Yes, the assessment is available for public review, and comments are being accepted until October 20th, 2025. This is significant for trade because U.S. regulations, specifically 9 CFR Part 94, restrict the importation of poultry and poultry products from regions affected by diseases like Newcastle to protect our own domestic flocks.
So this decision, if finalized, could reopen trade for certain Swiss poultry products, connects directly to global biosecurity and protecting our food supply chain.
Absolutely.
APAS also has another notice, this one about changes to domestic quarantine areas. This sounds like pest control efforts within the U.S.
That's exactly right. APAS maintains lists of areas within the U.S. that are under quarantine restrictions due to the presence of specific invasive plant pests or diseases. This notice serves as an official update, informing the public about changes made to those quarantined areas during the year 2024.
What kind of pests are we talking about?
The notice gives examples of programs with updated quarantine lists on their websites. Things like the Asian longhorn beetle, witchweed, a parasitic plant, various fruit flies, citrus greening, a devastating citrus disease, and the pale cyst nematode, which affects potatoes.
So this is basically APIS saying, here's the official record of where we adjusted quarantine boundaries last year.
Correct. It highlights the constant vigilance required by agencies like APIS to detect, contain, and try to eradicate invasive species that threaten our agricultural economy and natural environment. It's an ongoing battle.
Now, this next notice, also technically under USDA jurisdiction via the FDA's animal drug role, is quite unusual. It involves the New World screwworm.
Yes, this one definitely stands out. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has formally issued a declaration. It recognizes a significant potential for a public health emergency that could affect national security or the health of U.S. citizens abroad, specifically involving the organism Cochleomyia haminorrax, the New World screwworm.
Screwworms. Those are fly larvae that infest wounds on animals, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes humans.
Exactly. They can be devastating to livestock, wildlife, and occasionally people. The U.S. eradicated them domestically decades ago, but they still exist in parts of the Western Hemisphere. An outbreak could be catastrophic.
So what does this declaration allow?
It formally justifies authorizing the emergency use of certain animal drugs to treat or prevent screwworm miasis infestation in animals. This declaration empowers the FDA commissioner to issue emergency use authorizations, or EUAs, for these animal drugs, bypassing the normal, much longer drug approval process.
So it's like the EUAs we saw for COVID vaccines, but for an animal drug against a parasitic fly.
Essentially the same legal mechanism, yes. It allows a rapid response to a potential biological threat, even a seemingly obscure one like screwworms, that could have significant economic and potentially health impacts if it reemerged. It shows the government has tools ready for rapid deployment against unexpected biological crises.
Okay, finally for our notices today, one from the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, FSIS. This involves the Codex Alimentarius Commission.
Codex. This is the International Food Standards Body. It's a joint effort of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the World Health Organization, WHO, established back in 1963.
And what's its purpose?
Its main goals are protecting consumer health globally and ensuring fair practices in the international food trade. They do this by developing harmonized international food standards, guidelines, and codes of practice.
So setting rules for food safety and quality that countries can adopt.
Exactly. This specific notice is about a public meeting being held by FSIS on September 11th, 2025. The meeting is to discuss the upcoming session of a specific Codex Committee, the Codex Committee on Spices and Culinary Herbs, CCSEH.
A whole committee just for spices and herbs.
Yes. They work on developing worldwide standards for dried and dehydrated spices and herbs, the things we use every day. The public meeting will allow stakeholders in the U.S. to discuss the agenda items for the International CCSCH meeting, including draft standards for things like saffron, vanilla, sweet marjoram, coriander seeds, large cardamom, and cinnamon.
So it's a chance for U.S. industry and consumers to provide input that informs the U.S. position at these international standard-setting meetings.
Precisely. It's a deep dive into the international cooperation that happens, often behind the scenes, to ensure the safety, quality, and fair labeling of the food on your plate, no matter where in the world it originated.
Presidential documents.
Now, you might be wondering about presidential documents, things like executive orders, proclamations, presidential memoranda. These are also a key part of the Federal Register, right? They formalize actions taken by the president.
Absolutely. They are a distinct and very important category carrying the weight of executive authority. The Federal Register is the official venue for their publication.
So, were there any in today's edition, August 20th, 2025?
Well, the table of contents for today's Federal Register does include page references indicating that various presidential documents were published. However, the actual content of those specific documents wasn't included in the source material we used for this deep dive today.
Ah, okay. So we know they're in there, but we can't discuss the specifics of what the president directed or proclaimed today.
Exactly. We can only acknowledge their presence and their importance as a category of federal action published in the register.
Yeah.
It just highlights that even in a deep dive like this, our analysis is limited by the specific source material available to us. Outro.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the Federal Register for Wednesday, August 20th, 2025. Wow. From helicopter safety rules and complex DEA enforcement actions.
To managing flood risks that affect homeowners, setting global food standards for cinnamon, authorizing oil exploration in the Arctic, and even preparing for screwworms.
It's truly remarkable how much federal activity across such a huge range of topics unfolds and is formally documented in just one single day's publication.
It really is. And what's fascinating, I think, is seeing how these seemingly disconnected items, a fee change at the NSCC, a Hep C testing initiative, a J-1 visa form, are all threads in that vast interconnected machinery of government.
Right.
Each one, in its own way, is designed to protect or regulate or provide services across almost every facet of society. And it makes you wonder, doesn't it, how might a single day's worth of these entries taken together signal broader trends? Shifts in policy priorities, technological advancements driving new regulations, or evolving public welfare concerns.
That's a great point,
Yeah.
indeed. So next time you hear about a new government initiative or a changing regulation, remember it almost certainly started its public life as a notice or a rule right here in the Federal Register. So what piece of this deep dive will you explore further? Thank you for joining us on the deep dive. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Taylor Johnson.
We'll see you next time for another journey into being well informed.